Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Okay. Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I pray that you're thinking back about what a wonderful Christmas you had with your family and your friends, that there was memories, joy, peace, worship, and sweetness that is going to last far, far into 2025. We at Them Before Us Radio, we are all about the best things in life, specifically those familial relationships that are so foundational and fundamental to what it means to be human. And I pray that you were able to feast upon those relationships over the last week. Maybe you weren't, and maybe you experienced some sorrow and sadness. We're going to talk and touch on a little bit about that over the course of the next segment or two. But I want to kick things off with Bible time. I have been going through Exodus and slowly working my way through the Ten Commandments because it is thick, people. It is thick. There's so much to be learned here. I didn't even get into the commandments. I was just in verse one of Exodus, you know, and God spoke all these words saying, and then I stopped, read several commentaries. And what is so incredible about the law of God, specifically the Ten Commandments, is that all of these sins that are widely acknowledged across different cultures are acknowledged in the Decalogue, in the Ten Commandments. They are forbidden, but you know, one commentator, F.B. Meyer, said they were forbidden because it was pretty much already acknowledged in our conscience that these things are fundamentally wrong. And that's not to say that just because something is forbidden by nature that you're not going to override your nature, but it does tap into what is recognized in Romans chapter 1, that what can be known about God is clearly seen by what has been made. And both that commandment, that acknowledgement at the beginning of Exodus 20, as well as the general revelation that's spoken of in Romans chapter 1, speaks to something that we at Them Before Us refer to as natural law. And not just we, but there's an entire philosophy of natural law. And that is the understanding about what you ought to do, a system of morality, not necessarily based on explicit commands by God, but things that are written into the natural world and over the human heart, natural law. And a lot of the work that we do at Them Before Us is based on natural law. When we advocate on behalf of children's right to life, when we talk about their right to their mother and father, when we decry the designing of children through reproductive technologies, when we denounce the intentional separation of children from their mother through surrogacy, when we insist that children who have been lost their parents should be adopted into loving mother-father homes whenever possible. We do so not necessarily on the word of God, but appealing to the world of God, this natural law reality of the fundamentals of the human child. And one of the reasons we do that is tactical. We don't want people to be able to dismiss this claim that children have to their own parents because we are appealing to scripture, an authority that they do not necessarily recognize. We will appeal to a universal authority, something to which their knees must bow, and that is the created world that God has instilled and inculcated in us, in our conscience, as the Apostle Paul says, something that is undeniable. And so I stopped there and I thought, obviously God explicitly states these critical commands, including the inherent value of the parent-child relationship in the first command that speaks to human relationships, not the relationships between human and God. And obviously, you know, we value that and we advance it in our work, but we are working to do it in a way that is really distinct from some of the other organizations that are working in the pro-life, pro-family space. To help me kind of tackle this Bible time, as well as some issues that we think are really pertinent to the Christmas season, I've got my executive director, Josh Wood, joining us per usual. Josh, thoughts on natural law, maybe just on the work of Them Before Us in general, and kind of the distinctive ways that we're informing the conversations on marriage and family.
Well, I don't think you need to speak English, to be Christian, to be from the United States or England, you know, Gambia, to understand and feel something deeply when you see a child removed from their mother, when you see, to be filled with empathy for the orphan. It is something just deep inside of us that says, well, that's absolutely not right. There's a reason we can't even study some of this stuff, because it's unethical to pull children intentionally away from their parents, from their mom and dad. We know this to be true deep in our bones, that kids belong with the people that created them. And it's a fundamental injustice when that harm is done intentionally. It's bad enough that it happens through tragedy or negligence. But I think when I hear that phrase, even for someone who's not acquainted with the philosophy, it's easy to just say, well, but you know deep in your heart that the kid belongs with the person that created them. And this there's something magical about the fact that it's a mom and a dad forever and always that have created a child. So I think sometimes it can get lost in the science or the philosophy. What is it? Do I agree with it? Is it religious? Is it not? I think it's just saying, hey, it speaks to our human hearts and our human experience that we are filled with empathy and compassion when a child is taken from the two people that they look like, that they were created by, and that statistically are the safest place for them. And that's a good indicator that that was built into you naturally. And again, the law part means we got to protect it. We need to ensure and enforce that these kids stay connected to them.
Yeah. As we often say at Them Before Us, we are so grateful to for the hundreds of organizations that are fighting for children's right to life. That right is under attack. We need every one of those organizations going to battle on their behalf. We are the only nonprofit defending children's rights on this side of the womb, their rights to their mother and father in those primary relationships. And that gives us incredible clarity and courage when speaking about matters of marriage, divorce, third-party reproduction like sperm and egg donation, IVF, surrogacy, adoption, polygamy, cohabitation, single mothers by choice, who gets to go on a birth certificate. If it has to do with marriage and family, we will give you the child protective answer to it. And if that resonates with you, or maybe you've been listening over the course of the last couple months and you think, yes, this is so important, not just to the individual child, but to our nation and our society as a whole, we would love for you to join us to fuel this child-centric, this movement of child protection across the globe. We'd love to have you financially partner with us in this epic work of child defense in matters of marriage and family.
Well, we want to talk just a little bit today about Christmas relationships. You know, this is one of the most prevalent times for rates of suicide to spike, because people are being reminded of very difficult past memories, painful relationships, and are being forced to navigate those. And we have the quote from Bonhoeffer that we belong to one another only through and in Jesus Christ. It's the belief that we've been reconciled to Christ is the reason that we're able to reconcile to one another. And I think that's an important part of, again, this might be bringing up painful memories for you in this season, because unfortunately what we're fighting against is at its core is this, you know, war against adult desires and the way that they can really impact not just yourself, not just your relationship potentially with your spouse, but often those people around us that become collateral damage in a lot of these situations. And so, you know, we have just a couple of, you know, notes I just want to get your feedback on, but it's adults with divorce in their backgrounds experience diminished outcomes in all aspects of their professional and personal lives and have an increased risk of depression and bipolar disorder. Again, these are just some of the things, the reason why we do what we do, that stepchildren suffer more adverse family experiences, putting them at statistically higher risk of poverty, having mentally ill caregivers, witnessing violence, exposure to drug and alcohol, or having an incarcerated parent. Kids being split between two homes can often develop a split self, exhibiting two different personalities to fit their different home lives. Even the biblical, you know, nature of divorce, which we believe in times of, you know, abuse or neglect, we do need to expedite that process. But, you know, statistics show us 70% of those divorces are low conflict. So even when divorce is warranted, we know it harms kids. But when it comes from these low conflict marriages, we believe it to be, you know, an injustice. So again, as we're entering Christmas season, no one doubts that these tough relationships can be difficult to navigate. We can validate you that adult decisions often do harm children, and maybe you were a child that went through this. But Katie, I'd love to just chat about how do we do this? How do we navigate these things? What advice do you have for someone that's experienced some of these negative, you know, impact of these negative decisions and is now having to try to find the words to express themselves and to reconcile potentially with parents or siblings, you know, who have made these choices?
You know, if you're the child who lived through it, even if you're an adult now, what we've found at Them Before Us in our work is one of the things that we do is we catalog the stories of children who have experienced family breakdown or mother and father loss. And I'm always fascinated that it usually takes 10 years of being out of the home before somebody is able to honestly reflect on the harm of the divorce or the struggle of not having a dad. And maybe they felt it or recognized it, or maybe they had, you know, undercurrents that bubbled up to the surface and lashed out through behavioral issues while they were teenagers. But it's not until early adulthood, like sometimes when you're forming your own family, but it looks like you need to be out of the house for 10 years before you have the distance and the independence to be able to honestly self-reflect. So maybe that's where you are for the first time going, you know what? That was awful. And I did pretend like everything was okay for a while because I was trying to keep, you know, my new stepmom happy, or I was still the mediator between my mom and dad, or I didn't want my mom to feel so bad that my father had left and I wanted to be, you know, tough for her. And maybe you're at the place where you're finally like, oh my gosh, that was really hard. Maybe you've had your own kids yourself and you went, whoa, this is what it's like to have a child and to be this close to them. And my father just left me. So a lot of times it is when you move into those seasons of maturity and independence that you're able to honestly reflect. My number one thing to say is you're right. If you're experiencing pain or confusion or sadness, or you realize this burdened me in ways that I hadn't realized, you are right. And there was probably a lot of voices and messages that you heard when you were young saying, oh, you're fine. Everything's okay. Oh, at least you have two Christmases. You know, well, at least now your father has found love or whatever it is. And you had to go along. You, in essence, had to be the adult in the relationship, being understanding, supportive, and accommodating of your parents. And now you're at the place where you go, actually, that was really painful. And it looks like it has had, you know, Josh just read off some stats about some of the physical ailments that can go along with the divorce, you know, that kids of divorce are more likely to be chronically ill, you know, probably because their systems, their little systems were put in sort of a constant state of inflammation with a fight or flight response, you know, that higher cortisol level, the stress levels rise, and that can lead to increased chronic illnesses. Maybe you're just noticing that it's harder for you to trust people in general, that, you know, you avoid marriage or you avoid commitment because you feel like it's so painful. So I think it's just okay to say, this hurt me. There's fallout. Recognize it. And then I'd encourage you, find some good counsel. Maybe it's a therapist. Maybe it's a counselor. Maybe it's just a man or a woman who's a few steps ahead of you, who's godly and mature, with whom you can speak everything, tell everything, and fully process, because you're going to have to do something hard. And that is, you're going to have to break the cycle. You're going to have to be the one that says, I'm not going to subject my kids to this. I'm going to do something differently.
Well, and as parents, do the same. Validate when you've made a hard decision. Own up to it. Give your kid that ability to do some of the healing by taking ownership of it. And of course, the best thing to do is to get upstream of this. And that's the work that we do, which is trying to educate people before the harm's inflicted. And if you want to support our work, of course you can. Thembeforeus.com. You can go donate and make a gift. We would love to have you.
Yeah. Stay tuned. We're going to hit some more content that is very relevant for the holiday season in our next segment. But Merry Christmas. We're so glad you're with us. And we will see you again on the flip side.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio, the final episode of 2025. I just want to say that this was a delightful surprise. This radio show, being invited by American Family Radio to create 1 hour a week of child protective content for you and to be able to connect with you. This has been an absolute joy that I wasn't expecting in 2024. And I'm just grateful that you choose to join us and come along for this journey, that you give your attention to the cause of putting children's rights before the desires of adults. And especially looking at what's happening in the culture today, not through the lens of what adults want, but how we can protect kids. So we're going to hit a couple news stories that have cropped up over the last couple weeks that are somewhat timeless, that really dial down into the question of what does it mean to be human? We talked so much about the importance of relationships and connection and the struggles when those fundamental family bonds break down in a child's early life. But we are seeing confusion among the next generation, even in terms of what constitutes a real relationship. So there was a headline of 1 in 4 young adults believe that AI, artificial intelligence partners, could replace real life romance. Now, this should be shocking to us, but it's also a flashing light towards the fact that the up and coming generation is incredibly confused about relationships in general. Some of that, I think, can be tracked back to many of them didn't grow up seeing healthy relationships or healthy marriages, and therefore maybe not even healthy friendships, because so much of the way that we learn to love happens in the staging ground of the home. And without that security, sometimes it's hard to form secure friendships even outside of the home. But then you introduce the technological invention of the internet and pornography, that so many of these kids grew up consuming porn. They already had a digital form of pseudo connection, sexual connection through the pathway of porn. So maybe an AI romantic partner seems like something even less extreme than the kind of online content they've already been producing. So Josh Wood, my executive director, is here, and I'd love for you to share a little bit more, Josh, just about like what we're seeing in terms of the trends of the next generation as they look forward to or consider or conceptualize what AI is going to add to their life, even in a romantic context.
Well, it's not surprising that 55% of adults younger than 40 view AI technology as threatening or concerning, 45% intriguing or exciting. So the older crowd, the younger crowd, they're kind of split right now on, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Unfortunately, you know, even though there's small numbers right now, it's kind of wild how open people are to AI being, you know, somewhat of a romantic partner. You know, for young adults who are not married or cohabitating, it says 7% are open to a romantic relationship with AI. That is pretty wild. I didn't know this either, that an analysis of 1 million ChatGPT logs found that sexual role playing was the second most common use. What you're beginning to see are, you know, I think what your point about porn was right, that most people already have a romantic relationship with a computer, and it happens through porn. And so in some ways, they see AI and the potential to create bots and to talk to them or play out their fantasies is actually just not opening a new road. It's just making an already well-worn path for them more lifelike. So why wouldn't they be open to it? I think that trend, coupled with there's actually less sexual interaction between this age group and other real life human beings, and you're seeing that with a lowering even with real life friendships, leading to more isolation and depression. All of that's a pretty worrying trend that I would categorize as young adults are more disconnected and are searching, like we all have deep in our hearts. We talked about natural law earlier. We all have these things within our hearts that must get filled, but this group in their isolation is just turning increasingly to whatever the digital world can provide them, because it's safe, it's private, it doesn't have the risk involved, it doesn't require much energy or effort. And, you know, in a way, it's going to dull them down to where they don't have to develop some of these relational characteristics. They don't have to experience the rejection, the loss, to work on themselves, because they can just close a tab, reopen it, find a new, you know, digital partner and move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that you're like, is this a chicken or an egg situation? Because, you know, we've been doing youth ministry to some degree for close to 30 years now. And I remember just even when, before there were smartphones and it was just texting, I remember being in the youth room, you know, where you've got all the couches and you've got two kids sitting next to each other, a boyfriend and a girlfriend, and they're not even talking to each other. They're text arguing. They're not even looking each other in the face. So even when they're in the same room, they were preferring to have a digital connection rather than a real life connection. And I have seen more anxiety around in-person relationships for this up and coming, you know, group of Gen Z, even around things like wanting to go into a store alone and talk to a clerk, because now we can just digitize our orders. There's not as much of a need to actually interact with somebody at Target when you can just sit in your car and have it handed over to you or dropped off at your door. And so the truth is that when it comes to personal connection, we're made for it. But it's also a bit of a skill. It's also something that you have to practice, especially when it's somewhat high stakes, which romantic relationships are. There is the potential for wonderful joy and connection, and also the potential for horrible rejection. And what is it that these AI girlfriends or boyfriends offer? And that is simply somebody that will never reject you. Somebody you can customize. There's very little risk. And so you can look at something like this and say, okay, well, there's low risk. And so you're going to get in on that intervention, that option for connection. Or you can say, you know, we actually don't have kids that are able to connect in person at all. And so maybe they're going to opt for some kind of connection because they're so afraid to just connect in real life. So I think this is highly concerning. And ultimately, this comes back to the fundamental question of what does it mean to be human? This is a question that only churches can answer. Only churches, only the biblical worldview has the right answer to the question, what does it mean to be human? Which is made in the image of God, fundamentally beings that need to be in relationship with one another, and that you are a body-soul unity. I mean, you can look at a lot of the AI functions and say that's intelligence. But it's not a body. Like, you really need to have both. You need to be an embodied intelligence. And so AI is never going to be able to replace that fundamental connection, because we're made for human connection, not just pseudo-intelligent connection.
Well, I do think it will not be long before these have physical manifestations, whether they are through, you know, things like sex toys, things like, you know, potentially these types of robots. There will be a market for it. There will be people who prefer to spend lavish amounts of money to avoid this type of risk and to see their, you know, pleasure, to get their pleasure, to see their desires, you know, fulfilled. So it's definitely on its way, which I think for us then as Christians, we just have to be prepared with an updated apologetic that talks, you know, about things like sexual chastity, talks about the importance of real face-to-face relationships, living in community, the accountability that comes with that, even community as a concept, that isolation is not good for you. It's not good for man to be alone. And pushing people back into churches, back into, you know, extended connected family structures, all of those things are very good. But it's coming at a time, and this kind of gets into our second article, it's coming at a time where culture is taking a left turn into isolation and the loneliness that comes with that. So we have another study that's coming from Heritage, talks about the loneliness epidemic and the culture it's creating that's actually shunning marriage. Do you want to get into that?
Yeah. And unfortunately, this is a really tough trend that we are seeing, you know, higher rates of unmarried adults. The adults that are married tend to be more often childless. Like, we are creating isolated islands, you know, people that are disconnected, you know, we're seeing a decline in organized religion. We're seeing a decline in all the ways where people used to find organic embodied connection. So this heritage report, you know, it talks about that modern approaches to relationships are decreasing the likelihood of getting married and staying married. And, you know, we talked about that, you know, children of divorce, unfortunately, are less likely to get married. And if they do get married, they are more likely to divorce. You know, the report has a quote, "Today's culture tells people to put off marriage until they have accomplished multiple personal achievements. The list of expected accomplishments before marriage includes completing an education, establishing your career, purchasing a home, dating, having a sexual relationship with multiple people, as well as being able to afford an elaborate wedding," I would say, "and travel and finding yourself and paying off your college debt." And I mean, really what we're doing is we're communicating marriage as a capstone, something to like add to the very top of a house that you've already built, rather than a cornerstone, something around which you're going to build your life with somebody else. And unfortunately, these messages about marriage as something that is optional or that it's good for you to delay it is one aspect of this increased isolation that we're seeing.
Well, and we can't even blame it on the kids. This Pew survey from 2023 said that only 20% of parents said it's extremely important or very important that their child gets married. And the same percentage said it's that important to have kids of their own. You contrast that with 90% of parents said it's extremely important that their children are financially independent. That tells me everything I need to know about our culture's value systems. Because, man, you can have a lot of money and be very lonely at the end of your life. You can invest in all the wrong things. I think this tells me that we are more and more focused on safety, security, and being pursuing wealth over some of these eternal realities that bring and have brought. The Bible talks about this same dichotomy of pursuing things that are just vanity. Mm-hmm. And so humanity's dealt with this forever. We know. We have so many people telling us that's empty. It's an empty life, and that you're going to find so much more fulfilling in pulling and investing in things that are bigger than you and that will live past you. But we're falling in the same trap that our ancestors did, pursuing those temporal things.
Yeah. Some of the data from this report is very stark. It says data from the last census showed that 30% of homes in the United States were single occupancy, one person living in a house, 30% right now. That's compared to only 7.7% in 1940, right? So you've seen a nearly fourfold increase in people that are living alone. That is tough. 14% of adults currently live alone, and that 57% of men and 59% of women reported feelings of loneliness. And what's nuts is that we are supposedly in the most highly connected era ever. I mean, we've got hundreds or thousands of Facebook friends. We've got tons of Instagram followers. I mean, I can't keep track of the number of ways that people can get in contact with me, whether it's email or Facebook messages or DMs or my Signal groups or my Telegram groups or just straight up text or my family group chat. I mean, like, there are a bazillion ways, more ways than ever, that we have to connect with each other. And we are more lonely than we have ever been. And again, it gets back to this, what does it really mean to be human? There is no substitute for embodied connection. So Josh, let's talk about what we as parents can do to set our kids up for success. To say, I actually want a real life girlfriend or boyfriend when I grow up, a husband or a wife. I'm going to prioritize marriage. I'm going to reject the digital substitute for romantic or platonic relationships. What is it that parents can be doing? You've got really, really young kids. So what is it that you can be doing maybe at your kids' ages right now to set them up for a life where they are going to be fully connected?
Well, first, are we farming out our parenting responsibilities to the iPad? You know, are we relying on digital? Are we communicating through even our parenting styles that it's just as good to have them in front of a screen? Now, look, we're not, you know, screen avoiders. We kids watch different shows, but it's very different than, you know, is 2 or 3 or 4 hours of screen time their daily norm? When you go, or when they have a birthday, are you buying them just all these consumer goods? Are you emphasizing trips and experiences, time together as a family? Even in your daily life, it's not realistic for every family to live on one income. And so I get that you might have childcare and all these different needs, but are you prioritizing though that we call it like the power hours, the like 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. when they're awake? Are you guys putting away technology and really investing quality time in them? I say all that to say, are we communicating through our actions what our values are? Are we talking about how good marriage is as the kids grow up and get into their teens? Are we demonstrating how much fun it is to be married? Are we talking lovingly about being kind of broke when you got married at 22 and how you're having to figure it out, and how you're both working and trying to make ends meet, and how that was just time you can never get back and you're so grateful for? That all of those things put together create a pro-family, pro-child worldview that, man, I've had success at work forever, Savannah, my daughter, but nothing beat taking you home from the hospital. I mean, that was just the best joy in the whole world. We can't underestimate even those very small testimonies. And are they going to be present enough through their life, through our words and examples, that they grow up having their values correctly in order?
Yeah. We want kids. We want our kids. We want all kids to have healthy relationships, healthy connections with friends, with their parents, with a future spouse. But the reality is, what is true in the spiritual world is true in the human world, and that is you need to taste and see. Taste and see that relationships are good. Hopefully that's going to happen mainly in your home as they're growing up. Give them lots of exposure to people of all ages through church, play dates. Let them taste and see that there's nothing like human connection. Lots of exposure to the real thing so they can reject the counterfeits. Stay with us. We're going to do Q&A next.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio, our final segment of 2024. Let me just say that it's been an absolute joy to spend a little bit of time with you every weekend, thinking about the world through the perspective of putting kids first, putting them before us, elevating the rights and well-being of adults, of children, above what adults want. And I'll tell you that there is no more important lens through which to view not only our own personal world, but policy and politics and culture than thinking about elevating the least of these, advancing justice for the weak, because that really is what Christians are called to do, protect the most vulnerable. And I'll tell you what, when you look at the variety of different groups that are being victimized, children are going to overpopulate those groups because children are inherently vulnerable, and it is our job as Christians to stand up for them. We've just spent a little time talking about the importance of relationship, family relationships, human connections, and certainly the importance of the parent-child connection. Relationships are at the core of what it means to be human. It's modeled for us by the Godhead itself. And we want to be able to take those relationship, those connection, those human realities into our everyday life, our conversations with our friends, our relationship with our own children and our spouse. So that's what we try to do in this final segment, is kind of rubber meets the road. How do some of these principles of putting kids first, what do they look like in real life? So we do that through taking your questions and trying to give you honest answers to them. Jen Friesen, my training director, is here with me, and she has been listening to you throughout the week and has brought some of the questions that you have asked us to be addressed in the segment today. Jen, I hope you had a very Merry Christmas, and it's great to have you back.
Hi, Katie. Good to be here. Love the holiday season. Time with friends, family, relaxation. We love it. Yeah, we have some good questions for you today. One of them, and I love this one, is someone asking, knowing that healthy marriages are so important for our society, what are some good tips for mentoring younger couples at your church or small group, or, you know, any place you might know other couples? What are some good things people can do?
Well, I think when you think mentorship, you think, okay, we're going to have dedicated time. We're going to cover these principles. We're going to read this book together. And you really may decide to do some of those things. Awesome. Fantastic. I personally, when I was young and married and did not necessarily have a healthy family relationship modeled for me in my childhood home, I didn't necessarily need a 5-point lesson on, you know, healthy aspects of marriage. What I needed was lots of exposure. I needed to witness healthy families functioning together. And I remember even before we were married, when my husband and I were dating and engaged, we were invited over to this sweet family home every Sunday, and it was amazing to just watch them sit down together at the table, to laugh together every now and then, to see a kid get in trouble, and then watch the dad calmly but firmly extend consequences to the child, and if they were obstinate and resistant, to calmly walk over, pick them up, set them in their room, draw some boundaries, come back to the table, and keep laughing with his wife and kids. It wasn't explosive. There wasn't any blame for it. It wasn't punitive, but it was a hard and fast line. And I really learned from that because I didn't have parents that disciplined in that same way. And I just needed a lot of exposure watching it, watching the two of them love each other, even though they were very, very different. You know, I learned, wow, you can have a successful, wonderful marriage, even if you are polar opposites, which welcome to the world of marriage, most people are. So I think that when it comes to mentoring young couples, the best thing you can do is pull them deeply into your life. Give them exposure. Let them see, let them behold you as a servant leader, as the man, or as the woman, deferring to him as the head of your relationship and modeling what it looks like to do that without being a doormat or a yes woman, but really to be a helpmate, somebody that is providing Holy Spirit style support, because that is what that word helpmate connects to, is it's the way that Spirit helps us as well. So this is not some like, you know, milk toast kind of help. This is powerful, supportive, targeted help. So show young women what it looks like to be a godly wife who is strong and who voluntarily submits herself to her husband. Like, I personally can read the Bible and love it all day long, but when I see it lived out in a godly woman or in a godly marriage or in a godly leader, I go, oh my gosh, that's what that looks like. And I want to be like it. So I think that when you're talking about mentorship for young couples, especially people that are not coming from intact or healthy homes of their own, what they need is mass exposure. Hopefully from one couple, even better if it's from two or three couples, probably from people that are a few steps ahead of them who've been married 5 or 10 or 15 years longer than they have, not so far removed that you can't remember the struggles of being new parents or in that honeymoon era, but not too close that you don't necessarily understand the pathway out of those challenges. So that's what I think. Like, if you see a young couple and they're open to being grafted in to your extended family, pull them in. What do you think, Jen? Because I know that you are deeply enmeshed in your church community. Do you have advice?
Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying for sure. I love even, you know, making an effort to be connected to single people in your church. I would say even you, let's say you're a seasoned mom and wife. I imagine there's still some couples you and Ryan gravitate toward who are a few years ahead of you, who are experiencing some things you haven't experienced yet, who are still pouring into you. It seems really important, no matter what our age and stage is, that there might be some folks we get to go be with that are pouring into us. And then we turn and encourage people maybe younger than us or in a different stage of life. But I love the idea of just being integrated into family life. There's so many friends in my church that have allowed me to see that more intimate family life. I see discipline. I see the positive things. I see little disagreements and how the parents handle it and get to go on little trips to go. I have a family. They invited me to go Christmas tree chopping down with them. It's just awesome when families don't see being a family as this exclusive, like only our immediate family gets to participate in everything. Of course, there's moments like that for sure, that maybe just for immediate family. But I just, any time that you can integrate other folks into that is so beneficial, I think, for everyone.
You know, it's interesting because we're talking about the context of like a young married couple, but several years ago, there was a woman who identified as a lesbian that was in our orbit a lot. And so we just invited her over a lot. And our kids were really little at the time. And I was in that sort of exhaustion phase of parenting. It was hard to be patient when they misbehaved or when they disobeyed or whatever. And I remember we had had her over for dinner many times. And so our kids just knew her, you know, Angela's coming over and Angela would be there. And like Angela was our friend. But I remember when our kids, there was a couple times where our kids really misbehaved, not just childishness, but really misbehaved, really disobeyed. And Angela told me later, she would cringe. She would just squish up and panic because she's like, oh no, what are they going to do to her? What are they going to do to the daughter? Like, I know that she told her, and she would just hold her breath. And Ryan or I would walk over and say, honey, we told you that if you cannot stop throwing your fork at the dinner table, you don't get forks anymore. I mean, you're not managing your fork well. So here is a plastic spoon. And if you mismanage your spoon, then it looks like you're done with dinner for the day. And so calm, so loving. And then, you know, if there was misbehavior again, she gets down. We love her. We say, okay, head on off. We're going to give it a try tomorrow. Or if she was successful with the spoon, we'd say, hey, thank you so much for managing yourself. You know what? At the next dinner, you're going to get a chance with the fork again. And she said, it was so incredible because you weren't even talking to me. You weren't even looking at me. She said, but I kind of felt like you were parenting me. Like I hadn't had that kind of patient, but firm and connected and explanatory parenting take place. I was just used to punishment. So just being exposed to, and we did not do everything right by any means, but in this sense, the way that we disciplined, actually, she said, it kind of mended some of my childhood wounds. And you weren't even directly dealing with me. So I guess all that to say, A, nobody's perfect. Nobody has the perfect marriage. Nobody's raising perfect kids. But if there's health and if there's joy and if there's an effort to grow in godliness, pull people into your orbit. Simply letting them behold you as a healthy family will help them become somebody who is healthier personally or in their relationships.
That's so good. Well, and I think how much more important is it that people see when you mess up and then repentance and restoration and things being okay? I had that conversation with someone recently, how nice it is to be a Christian adult where you actually acknowledge you can repent and receive forgiveness and the relationship be okay. That's not how many of us grew up. Silent treatment, things are just broken. You never talk about it again. And to see that there's actually a process of restoration with discipline, with whatever, is so healing for so much of us. We can be a part of that. But a lot of us have to learn that as adults again.
Yeah.
Okay. Next question. I thought this one was really interesting. Have you ever had your founder's principle go wrong? Maybe describe what that is, where you think you might have introduced something too soon or in too much detail when your kids were too young to handle it?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So the founder's principle is the idea that whoever hears something from first, your child automatically considers the expert. So you need to be the first person to talk to your child about something that is controversial, pornography, abortion, homosexuality, transgenderism, you know, the things that are somewhat controversial, especially the things that the world would like to disciple your child in, you need to get to them first. And it does not mean that you go into graphic detail about what they would find if they stumbled onto a porn website. It is a simple explanation of, hey, honey, there's a lot of screens in your life. Sometimes you might see pictures of naked people or people having sex. That's called porn. It's going to make you feel kind of yucky. If that happens, you can always talk to your dad and I. We can help you. That's what we're talking about with the founder's principle. So when it comes to my own kids, I cannot think of an example where it went wrong in terms, because we know our kids. And of course, we can explain things in an age-appropriate way, oftentimes that's tailored just for our kids. So for example, my second and third kid got things a little bit sooner because they heard some of the secondhand what I was saying to their oldest sibling. The fourth child was not ready for those conversations. And when I would say, would you like to know about this? He would say no. And I'm like, okay, then we can wait. But I will say there was a time where we were doing youth ministry, where we were talking about some challenging topics. And this was a long time ago. And the parents had not gotten to the kid first. And so it was a bit of a shock to the system of that kid. And their parents came to us and said, oh my gosh, this was a shock to his system. He wasn't ready for it. And they hadn't had the conversation with him first. So of course we were like, oh my gosh, we are so sorry. And this is, you know, back before a lot of people are doing this now, like in youth ministry, I send something home. FYI, we're going to be talking about pornography next week. So, you know, if you feel like your kid's not ready for that, don't send them. We're going to be talking about the chemical effect on the brain or whatever. I'm not going to be going into graphic detail, but if they have honest questions, I will answer them honestly. So not with my own kids, but you've got to be really careful when you're talking to other kids. Even if you're kind of in a role where you're in a teaching role, you don't necessarily know the background or the sensitivities about the kids. And that's exactly why it's the parents' job to talk about this and nobody else's.
Yeah, that's really good. Great to think about. All right, final few moments here. Someone wants to know what your favorite project coming up in 2025 will be for Them Before Us.
What? hard to narrow down. Obviously, we are full steam ahead on the documentary that we're working on with Focus on the Family. And, you know, I follow a lot of the trending news about like surrogacy and all of the ways that surrogacy can be detrimental to children, exploitive, you know, crossover into the world of trafficking, follow a lot of news, social science about the fallout of things like divorce on kids, the identity struggles of children who are, who have been created through sperm or egg donation. You know, recently read the story of an IVF mix-up where two embryos were swapped at birth and people gave birth to and were raising somebody else's genetic child. And then they had to figure out, do I give away this child that's not genetically mine, but who I'm bonded to? And like, I just read all kinds of really challenging, horrible things in terms of what the world is doing to kids culturally, legally, and technologically. And I think that our documentary with Them Before Us, which is going to come out in 2025, is going to be an antidote for so many of those things. We also have some big plans to take on big corporation in a way that we have not yet. We also have some policy recommendations for state level lawmakers that I'm very excited about, because I will go and speak at conferences to state level senators and representatives, or I'll go do workshops, you know, at different states, and I can get people really jazzed up and fired up and ready to protect kids. But for the first time, Them Before Us has had the bandwidth, the staff, and the funding to create policy recommendations so that when those state senators are fired up and say, I want to fight on behalf of kids, we can say, here's an entire menu of things for you to choose from to protect children legislatively in your state. So there's a lot of great things that are coming up, both in terms of the media landscape, in the policy landscape, in the business landscape. You know, obviously, we want to challenge the way that children are being harmed technologically, and some of our policy recommendations are going to do that. So, 2024 was a huge year of growth for Them Before Us. We went from 2 staff to 5. We had 6 major projects and initiatives. One of them was this radio show that we weren't expecting at the beginning of the year. And it has allowed us to connect with an entire demographic, an entire audience that we didn't know before, that didn't know us, and we're so grateful. 2025, more of the above. 2025 is just claiming more ground on behalf of children. And thanks for being a part of an amazing 2024. Hope you had a Merry Christmas. Have a Happy New Year. And we will see you in 2025.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.